Hello and welcome to Moms Fighting Autism. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernotitis. I wanted to let you know a few housekeeping things before we get started here. If you're tuning in via your internet, your computer, you can see the blue box on your screen. There's a button on the blue box that says slides, and that's where you would click to view the slideshow when it begins. You can synchronize your slides with either your phone or with the webcast audio, depending on how you're listening, by clicking the button at the bottom of the slideshow. You can mute your computer if you're listening via phone so you don't get an echo. If you're listening via your phone, if you're participating that way, you will have the opportunity to ask a live question by pressing star 2 once the question and answer session starts. So remember to press star 2 to alert me that you have your hand raised. Today we welcome Dr. Stephen Shore. Dr. Shore is going to be talking about turning deficits into strengths. I'll tell you a little bit about Dr. Shore. He was diagnosed with atypical development and strong autistic tendencies and too sick for outpatient treatment. Dr. Shore was recommended for institutionalization. Nonverbal until the age of 4, with much support from his parents, teachers, wife, and others, Stephen is now a professor at Adelphi University, where his research focuses on matching best practice to the needs of people with autism. In addition to working with children and talking about life on the autism spectrum, Stephen presents and consults internationally on adult issues pertinent to education, relationships, employment, advocacy, and disclosure, as discussed in his books Beyond the Wall, Personal Experiences with Autism and Asperger's Syndrome, Ask and Tell, Self-Advocacy and Disclosure for People on the Autism Spectrum, the critically acclaimed Understanding Autism for Dummies, and the newly released DVD, Living Along the Autism Spectrum, What It Means to Have Autism or Asperger's Syndrome. President Emeritus of the Asperger's Association of New England and former board member of the Autism Society, Dr. Shore serves in the Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee, Asperger's Syndrome and High Functioning Autism Association, and other autism-related organizations. Welcome, Dr. Shore.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure and honor to be here with you and with all of our listeners, people who are dedicated to helping those of us on the autism spectrum lead fulfilling and productive lives to our greatest potential. So I'm reporting from Toronto, Ontario, where I am presenting a poster session on my research to the International Meeting for Autism Research, otherwise known as IMFAR, which is the premier autism research conference in the world. So I look forward to that. And now on to the show. So what we're going to talk about today is the idea of turning challenges into strengths. And I like to use the word challenge rather than deficit is because sometimes I feel that people get caught up too much on that D word, the deficit word. When we think about diagnosis, when we think about education, when we think about people on the autism spectrum and people with disabilities in general, we tend to use a deficit model. And this really becomes apparent, for example, when a parent is told that their child has been diagnosed is on the autism spectrum, the first thing that they so often hear are all the things that the child will have difficulty doing or won't be able to do. And what I suggest is that we look at what people with autism can do. So looking at how to move towards or from challenges towards success, one thing that we have to consider is employment. Most of us have to work for a living. And if we want to find what people with autism will do best, have the potential for doing best, we actually ask the same questions that we ask anybody else. So how does the person spend most of their time, or would they spend most of their time if they could? And in doing so, based on these activities that they may engage in, What abilities can we see? What are the interests? What kind of mind does the person have? And this is an important question. We often think that individuals on the autism spectrum are visually based, and a lot of us are. I'm one of them. However, not all of us are. For example, I know some people with autism who are so non-visual that they can't even read a map. And also taking into account the characteristics of individuals on the autism spectrum and matching those to potential vocational and advocational possibilities. So getting back to the idea of challenges and moving away from a deficit model to a characteristics-based model, I like to think about reframing the characteristics of autism that we're all too familiar with in terms of what we hear about challenges or weaknesses in communication, ranging from not having developed a reliable means of communication to those of us who perhaps talk too much and don't know when it's time to give the other person a breather or a chance to talk, which leads us directly into social interaction. What can we look at in terms of the characteristics of how we may socialize, albeit differently, and translate that to success in the workplace? And finally, looking at those interests, those restricted interests as referred to in the DSM-4 and eventually the DSM-5. And to this end, this brings to mind a man on the spectrum who's very verbal, working in Paddington Station, England, providing information, transportation information to lost patrons. And he uses his communication style to do that. And if we think about the communication style of those of us on the spectrum who are verbal, may be considered to be in the high-functioning autism range or maybe Asperger's, I think most people will agree that it tends to be factual, detailed, truthful, to the point, and repetitive. And if we think of how many times, perhaps, you may have asked someone to repeat a set of directions they've given to you, well, that's repetition. So the communication style works. Now we look at social interaction. We think about, well, if someone has difficulty socially interacting, how can they handle the dozens or maybe hundreds of people they have to provide directions to every day? If we look at the type of social interaction in such an employment position, actually, it's a very predictable and narrow range of interaction. Everybody's coming to this person looking for how to get from one place to another. And this is information that this person can provide. So it's very predictable. And then finally, what about where this fellow gets his information? His coworkers have to look it up in a reference, whereas he's got it all memorized. So instead of calling it a restricted interest, let's think of it as a focused interest or perhaps even a passion. And strictly because this fellow has autism, he has the characteristics of autism, he outperforms his coworkers who don't have autism. And that's what I mean by looking at the characteristics and finding ways to use them to build, to work on strength, to build fulfillment, productivity, and leading a happy life.
Dr. Shore?
Sure.
The slideshow, are you advancing at the bottom? There's little triangles at the bottom.
And I was just about to hit the next triangle.
Okay, because I'm watching as a participant, and my slide isn't changing, so I just wanted to make sure.
Okay, yeah, my slide isn't changing either. So,
okay. All right, good.
Yeah.
Then we're on the same page.
Oh, we're definitely on the same proverbial page.
All right, thank you.
And this is a slide that we spend a lot of time on. Other slides, such as this one, that is the prelude to my talking a little bit about myself, goes by much more quickly. And so let's move on to starting at the very beginning, where my mother had just a two-hour labor at an APGAR of an 8 or a 9. And at 24 hours of age, my wife says, I looked like an egg. Then at 18 months, like what happens to about half of us on the spectrum, what I call the autism bomb struck. And I lost functional communication, had meltdowns, self-stimulatory behavior, withdrew from the environment, and in short became quite an autistic child. So the other half of us on the spectrum, something seems apparent at birth. And there was so little known about autism in those days. My parents had no idea what to do. As a matter of fact, it took them a full year to find a place for diagnosis. And only after finding this diagnosis, the doctors told them that they had never seen a child who was so sick, and they recommended institutionalization. Fortunately, my parents, like so many parents today, they advocated on my behalf and convinced the school to take me in about a year. So it was during that year that my parents provided what we would today term as an intensive home-based early intervention program. And I dare say that it did have a reasonable amount of success, as I now, as was mentioned in my introductory biography, I serve as a professor of special education at Adelphi University, I write books and articles on autism, travel around the world, up to 29 countries across 6 continents so far, and 45 states in the U.S. and half the provinces in Canada, talking about autism. And then during the times that I'm home, which is every now and then, I give music lessons to children on the autism spectrum. So that makes me believe that we have the ability, we have the resources, we have the know-how, we have the technology to where we can help individuals on the autism spectrum lead fulfilling and productive lives, and this can become the rule as opposed to the exception. What we're really challenged with is providing resources for these approaches, and then finding a way to match approaches to the needs of individuals on the autism spectrum. And if we can do this, leading a fulfilling and productive life can become the rule rather than the exception. And rather than being a bomb, perhaps autism can become da bomb. So what are we doing to better understand autism, as it seems to be coming by the truckload on federal express vehicles, where the incidence rate is now 1 in 88. That's an awful lot of autism. Well, let's take a look at the autism spectrum. We're going to take a magical musical mystery tour of autism. And it's important to look at this as we transition from the DSM-4 to the DSM-5. With the DSM-4, we have our subtypes ranging from what's often referred to as classical autism or Kanner's autism. This often seems to refer to individuals who haven't developed a reliable means of communication. And we have a hard time figuring out their needs and wants and how to interact with them, all the way to the right side of the spectrum, where we see people who tend to be referred to as having high-functioning autism or Asperger syndrome. So I mention these subtypes because they're all going to disappear and get subsumed into a category called autism spectrum disorder. So there's a certain amount of sense to that. The whole thing is autism. However, there's going to be some additional changes that will require transition in terms of diagnoses and seeking services. And that is the people on the more severe end of the spectrum. We're going to find those individuals, and many of them, being given a diagnosis of global delay. And then on the right side of the spectrum, those who now have Asperger syndrome or what we consider a high-functioning autism, many of those individuals will be reclassified as having a social communication disorder, or perhaps maybe they won't have a diagnosis at all. And there's a lot of unanswered questions about these proposed changes. Nobody knows how it's going to play out. But what I can say is that it will be quite a transition as we have to construct new assessment instruments, or maybe we don't, because the individuals are still the same, whether we refer to them as having autism or something else, but we will have to create new bureaucratic structures in which to provide needed services. Now, that circle in the middle indicates where I landed on the autism spectrum at about age 2.5. So these days, I probably would have been considered to have moderate autism, because while I lost functional communication and had meltdown, I still had some awareness of the environment. And one last thing to consider about autism, or the autism spectrum, is the idea of twice exceptionality. And I point that out here because, again, in addition to considering the challenges that people with autism have, it's important to be aware of potential corresponding strengths. And one way to look at autism is to be is that those individuals have an extremely widely varying skill set, extreme strengths with extreme challenges. And to this end, for example, I think of a friend of mine who contributed to my second book on self-advocacy, Ask and Tell, which you can see a piece of it peeking out in the right side there, where I asked my colleagues on the autism spectrum, how are we going to teach people with autism to advocate on their own? Because there was very little conversation about that. And this book is a result of five of my colleagues essentially writing, this is how it's going to be done. So one of these colleagues, Cassiana Sibley, she's nearing 30 years old, and she has a verbal IQ of over 200. Now, those of you who are familiar with scoring IQ tests know they don't go that high, so it's just a guess. She probably wrote the best chapter in the book, but at the same time, she has such challenges with social interaction that she's not going to be able to find employment the way most of us think about finding and keeping a job. So that's what I mean. That's an example of extreme strengths coupled with extreme challenges. And what can we do to help an individual like this very person to make good use of their strengths? So moving along, at 2.5, that's when my parents finally were able to find a place for diagnosis. And in refuting the professional's recommendations for institutionalization, my parents implemented what we would today refer to as an intensive home-based early intervention program, emphasizing music, movement, sensory integration, narration, and imitation. So it probably looked very much like one of the developmental approaches we have today, such as the developmental cognitive approach of the Miller method, or the developmental affective approach of floor time, or RDI. And what did my parents do? And it was mostly my mother. My dad was there too, but in those days it was dad's job to hunt a saber-toothed tiger or a mastodon, while the mother stayed home and did mommy things. Well, first she tried to get me to imitate her, and that didn't work. So then she flipped it around. And once she started imitating me, I became aware of her and my environment. And then we were able to move along. And I think the important implication is that before any teaching goes on or meaningful interaction, you have to be flexible enough to find a way to develop a trusting bond with the individual. Once you do that, then you can move on. So the zone of intention that I have here is it's a term developed by Arnold Miller, which describes a person's awareness of the environment around them. And what Miller discovered is that people with autism often have a very small zone of intention, which may explain why that when we try to get the attention of somebody with autism, we don't get a response. And it's often not because we're ignoring you, but we don't even know you're there. And part of our job is to find ways to expand this zone of intention. So moving on, at age 4, based on the work that my parents had done with me, speech was beginning to come back. So instead of looking at those closed doors that you see there, my parents forced them open, and with the work they did, speech was beginning to return. They also noticed that I would go into the kitchen, pull a sharp steak knife out of the drawer, and use that knife to take apart watches. So I'd pop open the back of a watch, take out the hands, the gears, everything, and then put it all back together again. And I found it very enjoyable. And again, instead of looking at that as perhaps a weakness or a challenge or aberrant behavior, they found a way to support that interest.
Dr. Shore, if you can hear me, you've gone silent.
So,
you're coming back a little bit.
Dr.
Shore?
Yeah?
You kind of cut out there for a few minutes. You might want to back up to they used either your interest in clocks and watches.
Okay. So they used my interest in clocks and watches. They supported this interest. And soon,
folks, we wait for Dr. Shore to return. If you have not yet checked out the recent autism conference that we've done, please go to momsfightingautism.com and check out the conference. You can buy it as a set, and you'll get all of the recordings that we recently did. We had some really great speakers and some really great topics. And I would encourage you to do that. You can also join the Spectrum Gold Club. It's just $1 for the first month, and you'll have access to over 40 webinars.
All right, now I'm back.
Hey, welcome back.
Yeah, I don't know when it cut out.
it was shortly after I asked you to repeat the clock thing.
Oh, okay, so back to the clock.
Sorry.
My parents, instead of looking at this as aberrant behavior or a challenge or a weakness, maybe more interested in clocks instead of interacting with people, they found a way to use that as a strength, and soon there were all kinds of other devices to take apart. They sat with me and made sure I got them all back together again. And had it been a previous century, perhaps I would have been a really good watchmaker or a repair person. But instead, later on, that skill got generalized to bicycle repair, which became a great way to earn money in high school and in college. So that's another example of taking a look at something and being a little bit creative instead of giving up on it or thinking of it as strange or aberrant, finding a way to use it as a strength. So we move along. Here I am in kindergarten. I was a social and academic catastrophe in kindergarten, even though speech had pretty much come back. I didn't know how to get along with my classmates in a way they could understand, and there was a lot of bullying, teasing. Teachers didn't quite know how to reach me either. And I was usually about a grade behind in math and in reading. However, bicycles became quite the interest. And once I figured out how to stay upright on a two-wheeler, I'd spend hours riding my bicycle and also taking it apart and more or less getting it back together again, again transferring that mechanical ability and interest to bicycles. So moving along, we think about success in adult life, and it's important to realize that preparing for success starts early. It starts, I believe, as soon as you know somebody has autism. Maybe that's 2.5 when they get a diagnosis. It doesn't mean that you're going to plan their entire life for them at that time, but it's important to start noticing where the preferences are, where their strengths are, what are their interests. So how do we help prepare for success in the area of employment and other areas of life? And I think a good way to begin is with possible jobs. Some people call them chores, but they have a negative connotation, so let's call them jobs that have to be done around the house, whether it's feeding and taking care of animals, whether it's emptying the trash, whether it's making one's bed. And the key to these jobs is that they have to be done on a regular basis, whether you want to do them or not, and you have to perform them at a certain proficiency. And this initiates good work habits that will be helpful later on when still even as a youngster, maybe as a teenager in middle school or high school, you can start looking at jobs that might be done around the community, whether it's taking care of other people's animals, washing cars, doing lawn care, doing a paper route. I don't see many paper routes these days. Usually papers seem to be delivered by someone in a vehicle who tosses it out of the driver's side window. But in the Neolithic era, when there were paper routes, I remember that was a great way for me to learn to have to provide a service, to differentiate my service from other people by, for example, putting the newspaper between the storm door and the main door of a house so the customer could just open their door and the paper would fall in instead of having to go out possibly in the rain or snow to get their newspaper. Additionally, you have to get paid, so that means you got to get your money, you got to collect it. And that was a weekly chore until I decided to convert all of my customers to paying by the month. And in that way, I only had to travel to people's homes once a month instead of once a week, sharply reducing the amount of time required to do this, to collect the money for the papers delivered. But again, there aren't that many paper routes these days. So, however, the same ideas can be generalized to other positions. Moving to age 8, here I am in third grade. I spend hours cracking open rocks. I was fascinated by the shiny specks and sharp edges. Eventually, this turned into a special interest in geography and geology and many others. I remember one day I had a stack of astronomy books on my desk, busy taking notes and copying diagrams. And the teacher told me that I'd never learn how to do math. But somehow I've learned just enough math to teach statistics at the university level. Now, the good news is that today, an educator would notice this as a special interest or deep interest or passion and find a way to work this into the curriculum, making the curriculum intrinsically rewarding. And that's another example that looking at something that maybe in the past we would have considered it as a closed door of aberrant behavior, doing things differently. Now, maybe it's better to be outside playing during playing with other kids during recess as opposed to being so interested in astronomy or other things like I was. And I think finding ways to encourage these interests are important, because so often the reason why people in the autism spectrum are successful is because in one way or another they've managed to follow their interests, their passions, and become an expert in that particular area. The teachers didn't really know what to do with me, as I mentioned before, and since I wasn't a behavior problem, I think they just mostly left me to my own devices, for better or for worse. And in those days, it was probably for better. Special interests. As defined by Tony Atwood, an interest of such great intensity that it interferes with daily functioning. And it's a good definition, but I think it's still using a deficit model. I'd like to use more of if we use a more strength-based model, maybe we could define it as an interest of such great intensity that it provides a powerful motivator for daily functioning, learning curriculum, exploring career options, or whatever else we might want to use it for. So here are some of my special interests. They come and they go. Sometimes there's more than one at a time. And make sure you get them all, because there will be a quiz at the end. So at age 10, I was awfully concerned about the letter E, because I heard you have to drop E before adding ing. And wasn't this poor E going to get hurt when it fell to the ground? Isn't it poor social skills to be pushing letters around like that? I remember I had a friend who said he felt like a pizza. He didn't look like one. He didn't smell like one. So there were problems there. I remember as a teenager sitting in a restaurant and my mother suddenly saying, "Oh, look at that girl over there. She's giving you the eye." And what I thought that was a pretty disgusting thing to say. I didn't want her eye. I didn't want her to go blind. Her eye was better in her head. It was a gross thing to talk about during a meal. And really what we're looking at is that those of us on the autism spectrum tend to think more literally than others. And it may be because we have difficulty perceiving the nonverbal cues that indicate someone's telling a joke, using sarcasm, or perhaps using an idiom. So when you tell somebody on the spectrum to hold the door, this may be the impression that you get, or that the person with autism may get. So in considering the perception and decoding of nonverbal communication, we also get into the area of the rules. All those rules that everybody seems to know, nobody talks about, and you become a social outcast if you don't get these rules. So what we're talking about is the hidden curriculum, which is a term and the title of a book developed by Brenda Miles and colleagues that addresses this very issue. And the fact is that hidden curriculum is everywhere. The only time we don't find hidden curriculum is when we're by ourselves. So hidden curriculum can be found even in the bathroom. And here we have Bob and Sam. Sam came in second. And we see that Sam is making a couple of mistakes. The first is that when guys go to the bathroom, it's a very solitary and quiet experience. You don't look at the other person if there's somebody near you, and you take a stall that's further away. So the second mistake that Sam made is that he's too close. Going to the bathroom for a guy is not a time to work on good social interaction skills or eye contact. But if we contrast that with the ladies' room, I often see an entire row or table full of ladies all take their bags and go at once. When passing by these rooms, I hear a lot of noise. So there must be social interaction going on. And finally, I even hear some of these ladies' rooms have a couch so you can get comfortable. So very different social rules for different genders. And nobody talks about these things. But somehow, most people seem to understand them, but those of us on the spectrum may have more difficulty. And what that means, and what that suggests, is that we're going to have to provide direct instruction, whether it's via social stories, power cards, other social narratives, such as cartooning, even video modeling. And if you click on the link that's associated with this slide, then you'll see an example of video modeling from a DVD that's in production by Dennis DeBott and myself that focuses on helping the more independent person with autism who travels but may yet be challenged by all of the hidden curriculum or unspoken rules of traveling and remaining safe.
Dr. Shore, is this the shorter of the two videos or the longer of the two?
It's the shorter of the two videos.
Okay, so participants that are tuning in via their internet, you can click the link on your box that says video presentation, and it will bring up a new window. And there's the smaller video at the top is the one that Dr. Shore would like you to play right now. Is that right, Dr. Shore?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, certainly
okay.
Play it.
So go ahead and press play and watch this video. That's a wonderful video. We just had Dennis for one of our webinars for our recent conference, so that's wonderful.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Dennis has a lot of important stuff to say. He's the go-to guy when it comes to anything related to first responder training, whether it's police, fire, rescue, and as well as dealing with legal issues and things related to the courts. He's the guy to go to. Got great information in this area. And in fact, I'll be presenting with Dennis on a full-day workshop on May 24th at the Autism One conference. So anybody who's going to Autism One, come check it out. We'll spend a whole day with police, fire rescue people, and other first responders and learn more about preparing for potential encounters for individuals on the autism spectrum. All right, so moving along, what we have here are what I call incidental hidden curriculum books that are written for people with autism or any other condition, really, but they often humorously explain the rules of social interaction. The next book, maybe I need to write this for my next book. And what this book focuses on is how to reckon with a condition that's characterized by unusual and excessive eye contact. People with this condition have this pathological need for social interaction on meaningless subjects, such as the weather. And individuals with this condition also have this assumption that they know what other people are thinking. And really all I did was to describe typical behavior in the way that autism is described. And perhaps with the continued increase in the prevalence of autism, it may be that within the next generation, there'll be more of us on the autism spectrum than not. So maybe we really do need this book. So moving along, middle and high school, you don't need to have autism to have difficulties in middle and high school. But for me, it was actually easier because I figured out that using words instead of sound effects from the environment really helped with social interaction. I also discovered the band room. Being a musician, I now had a structured activity, the band rehearsal, in which to mediate my interactions with my fellow students. And in that way, it could become more successful with social interaction. Those of us on the autism spectrum will be much more successful in gatherings that are activity-based on a special interest, as opposed to those gatherings that are more socially based, such as a senior prom, which I skipped, by the way, and went to college orientation instead, or perhaps a dinner party. I mean, how many meltdowns have you seen when you bring somebody with autism to a family dinner party or dinner party with friends, and there's relatively less structure, and it becomes difficult for the individual with autism to handle. So what that suggests is that we need to find ways to insert structure into a relatively less structured situation. This is also... because music has been important in my life, this is also why I focus on giving music lessons to children on the autism spectrum. Because in addition to all of the therapeutic benefits for engaging in music, the individual now has a real-life key in which to develop interactions with others and get involved in the community in engendering more success in this area. Also, music is just plain old fun. And finally, I haven't figured out how to teach typical kids yet, so I just stick with the ones on the autism spectrum. So what that also suggests is part of being successful is seeking your areas of high functioning, you might say. So where does the individual do well? For example, I find that I'm pretty low functioning in a noisy bar. It's just too loud, sensorially overstimulating, and too much nonverbal communication going on. So I suppose I could engage in intensive intervention, perhaps auditory integration training for the hearing sensitivities, maybe take a little magnesium, There might be other things I could do to learn to better and more quickly decode nonverbal communication. Or what I could decide is that I can still lead a fulfilling and productive life without going into noisy bars and concentrating my time in places where I'm higher functioning, such as being an airplane passenger or serving as a professor or presenting at conferences. So it's a matter of finding out where your strengths are and pretty much remaining in that place as much as possible. However, sometimes an endeavor doesn't work out. And again, we're faced with these closed bank vault doors. And this reminds me of a position I had as a teenager. It was high school. And the position was serving as a busboy in a noisy restaurant, which ended up being a sensory overload situation. And as a result, I didn't have a meltdown, but it was sort of like a shutdown situation that work pretty slowly, which nobody liked because you need to move fast in these situations, which made me realize that this wasn't a good job for me and that I really needed to find something else to do, something that I'd be happier at, something I'd be more successful at. And what I would do is, thinking back to my interest in bicycles, I would get on my bicycle, which I built from the ball bearings up, and including building the wheels, taking the hub, the spokes, and the rim, and putting it all together. And I'd make the rounds of the bicycle shops in the area. There's about 12 of them or so. I'd go into the bicycle shop, strike up a conversation with the mechanic or the manager, talking about my bicycle, the different components, the gear ratios, basically just nerding out on the bicycle. And then at some point, I'd ask the person if I could get a job as a bicycle mechanic. And I went through about a dozen shops and got one offer of employment. And really, all you need is one. And now I had a job as a bicycle mechanic. And that was much better for me because, one, it was a special interest of mine. I was good at it. And I could regulate my sensory input by spending my time in the shop portion of the bicycle shop, fixing bicycles, or when I needed to come out and help a person choose a bicycle or buy a bicycle part. Now, again, I was talking about something that was of my favorite interest. So that was very successful, and I brought this interest to my undergraduate days, where I actually opened up a small bicycle repair shop in my dorm room and would spend half a day on Saturday fixing other people's bicycles and making about $100, which was a lot of money in those days and certainly better than working as a work-study security guard or something of that nature. So sometimes it's important to have the flexibility to change employment possibilities or where one might be working and moving to an area of higher functioning. That also means understanding what type of mind a person has. What are the cognitive preferences? And if we look to the work of Temple Grandin, she considers three main cognitive styles. The photorealistic thinker, who might be really good at geometry, but algebra, with all of those letters and numbers, may be quite the challenge. You might have another person who's a pattern thinker, and this is the one who might be good at music or math, but might find challenges in reading or writing. And then there are those of us who are really into verbal facts or word fact thinkers, and those of us may become challenged by drawing or even visual thinking. And I think the best way to consider this is that while we often may be visually based, perhaps even most of us, that's not always the case. And whatever type of mind we have, whatever cognitive style we have, learning style, whatever it's going to be at an extreme, and it's probably going to be at the expense of the other modalities. So again, it's important to think of this extreme skill set and finding ways for those of us on the spectrum to be successful. And then it's also important to consider what attributes we may have in terms of sensory input. Do we tend, those of us who seek it, those of us who avoid it, what type of sensory input? Communication. How does the person with autism communicate? And then finally, where are they on, you might say, the socialization scale, ranging from chatterbox to actually being quite shy. And as we think about these characteristics, as we should for anybody, whether they have autism or not, we can begin our work in matching strength to, in this case, employment situations. So moving along, as an adult, I entered college, which was a utopia. I had more friends. I wanted to ride my bicycle at midnight. I could find someone just as strange as I was to also ride at midnight. Dating occurs in college. That's an area where I definitely was and continue to be very low functioning. But, for example, I remember as an undergraduate, after spending a lot of time with this lady, she suddenly told me that she really likes hugs and back rubs. And what I thought was, and I took this very literally, I thought, gee, I've got this brand new friend, and not only that, she doubles as a deep pressure, Temple Grandin squeeze machine. Mm-hmm. But I guess she had other ideas. After a long conversation, I finally realized that not only did she want to be my girlfriend, she thought we had been dating for about a month. And I think this goes beyond typical male cluelessness. And it made me realize that there was this other area of communication, this other channel, this nonverbal channel, and that actually became a special interest of mine. I'd spend hours in stores reading body language books, building a lexicon of nonverbal communication, reading books on relationships, books on dating. And there are many, many books in this area, such as Dating for Dummies. And I think this is a challenge for a lot of people. I don't think all of these books are written just for those with autism. But anyways, I had read enough and figured out enough so that by the time I got to graduate school, after spending a lot of time with another lady, now working on homework, comparing each other's homeworks, and then moving on to social things, one day at a beach very much like this, she gave me a kiss, a hug, and held my hand. But at that time, I had the social story down, and it said something like this: if a woman hugs you, kisses you, and holds your hand all at about the same time, then it probably means they want to be your girlfriend. If that's the case, you better have an answer right away. And it could either be yes, it could be no, or it could be further investigation and analysis as indicated. Well, it seemed to be a good thing to do. And now we've been married for just about 22 years. And for people who want to find out more about what life is like on her side of the autism spectrum, then you can read her contributions to my autobiography, Beyond the Wall. And these days, as an adult, which I try not to tell too many people that I am, because they might make me do something serious or boring, I spend most of my time in a sheltered workshop for people with Asperger syndrome, where we perseverate on our favorite subject for days, months, sometimes years on end. Sometimes social interaction between community members are not the greatest. And some people refer to this as a university. If you want to find undiagnosed people with Asperger syndrome, just check out your professors. So in continuing to think about work, the question is, how do we match interests and strengths to careers? And how does this get done in a way that the person on the spectrum is contributing meaningfully to the organization and is doing a job, doing it well, and perhaps surpassing anybody else strictly because they do have autism? And one person who looks at this in a very refreshing and strength-based positive way is Dan Coulter and his Asperger Syndrome at Work, Success Strategies for Employees and Employers. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at an excerpt of this video where you'll see short vignettes of six people, all who have autism, and all who are meaningfully contributing to their employers. So this is the longer video, which now people can click on.
Okay. So again, if you aren't already at the video screen, you can click on the link that says videos or presentations. I think it says video presentations. And click on the larger of the two boxes. And that will start the course. Okay, my video is finished. And for anyone who's still watching, you can continue watching and join us for the slides when you're finished.
All right, so continuing on with the employment-related challenges and matching needs to possible positions, what I have here is a chart that considers what are the personal characteristics of an individual on the spectrum and how can we match that to job attributes and position. So let's take a look at one of these, such as unusual response to sensory stimulation. And what that brings to mind is when I was in Japan, talking with a parent of a teenager of a child on the spectrum, and what she told me is that one of his favorite activities would be to stick his finger under a water faucet and spray water around the house. Even though that she had about four or five mini floods, she still supported his interest. And she then asked, what can we do with this interest for employment? And so we discussed it for a while, and one idea that came up is possibly being a firefighter. And, well, what does being a firefighter have in common with this interest? Well, if we look at the sensory input that this child is receiving, there's a lot of pressure on his thumb or finger that's underneath the faucet that's spraying the water. The water makes a nice arc and splats against the wall on the other side, so you get some audio and you get some visual. And there's definitely water. You deal with water at high pressures as a firefighter. But looking at this individual's characteristics, we found that he was challenged in verbal communication. He had some limited verbal ability. And in order to be a fireman, you have to be pretty good at understanding commands that your captain barks at you, or you have to be able to issue them too to tell people to get out of a burning house, for example. So perhaps being a firefighter wasn't such a good idea. However, if this individual, and we didn't get that far, was really interested in things related to firefighting, maybe he could still bring that interest into a firehouse where maybe he could serve as a volunteer or perhaps even being paid for keeping fire engines clean, because it's very likely that you'd use possibly a power washer in which to clean the fire engine and maybe be the best fire engine washer in the region. And where else can you use a power washer? You can clean sidewalks, streets, buildings, and other things. So maybe that's a possibility. Often people might think, well, what about working in a greenhouse watering flowers? And there's definitely water involved, but it's certainly not at high pressure. And we'd want to figure out whether that was an important component to making a career choice successful for this individual. So these are some things that we think about in terms of looking at, in this case, sensory stimulation, but we can generalize that to other characteristics as well, whether it's difficulties with transitions, whether it's challenges in social interaction, or even communication. We could take somebody with really strong visual motor skills, and maybe nothing would make them happier than watching little parts come out on a conveyor belt, making sure that they're all properly formed and in the right place and everything was just so. Some people would be bored out of their minds doing this job. Others may find this something that is rewarding. Is there a way to use rituals and compulsions? And paying attention to detail. There's plenty of jobs that require that. So again, it's a matter of finding a way to match the strengths and interests to the position. And in fact, this is something that we do, or at least should do, for everybody who's looking for career opportunities and considering choices for what they want to do for work. When we look at employment structures, it's important to go beyond just the first three where most people seem to be, but there's all kinds of other possibilities as well. Self-employment seems to work very well for many people with autism. Temple Grandin, probably the most well-known person on the autism spectrum, attributes her success to being a consultant. She works for herself. And what that allows her to do, as it is for so many other people on the spectrum, it allows her to do her job. She goes in, does her work, and gets out before office politics take their toll. So self-employment can help. I have a friend who loves to stim on bright, shiny objects. And it turns out that he's a very successful coin dealer. So that's another example. Other things to keep in mind, considering the resources that exist, such as vocational rehabilitation counselors, generally jobs that are consistent in the areas of routine, social interaction, and that have tasks that are well-defined, increases the probability for success. Making work environments accessible. Sometimes it only requires a small adaptation. So, for example, you may have an individual with autism who has a visual sensitivity to fluorescent lights and perceives this type of lighting like most people perceive a strobe light. So that's fun on Halloween and during holidays, but certainly it would do a number on your productivity at work if you had to sit in a room all day with what was functionally a strobe light. So perhaps replacing fluorescent lighting. And studies show that everybody's productivity suffers to some extent under fluorescent lights. So removing those lights and replacing them perhaps with a different type of lighting will benefit the person with autism and benefit everybody else as well. And what I found, whether it's in education, employment, or in the community, that things that are good for people with autism tend to be good for everybody else as well. There's also getting back to the area of self-advocacy, teaching individuals with autism where their challenges and strengths are, and finding ways to help them advocate for themselves in a way that is successful, being able to scan the environment for challenges, whether they're sensory challenges, cognitive or socio-emotional, advocating or explaining their needs in a way that other people can understand and provide support, and then giving a reason why, and that's the disclosure. So, for example, many people with autism process written instructions better than verbal instructions. So might there be a way to ask or type directions for completing a job? So that gets us to the idea of advocacy. Teaching advocacy for success, which is predicated on being aware of where one's own challenges and strengths are. So when I consider advocacy, I think it promotes success to think of this three-step plan, which begins for scanning or looking for the challenge. And that can be done in three realms. One example we'll look at is the sensory realm, perception of the environment. And we've talked a little bit about this. What about the individual who has a sensitivity to fluorescent lights? Is there a way that they can ask their supervisor to perhaps change the lighting, and doing it in a way that the supervisor can understand and perhaps and provide support, not having a meltdown, not getting undue anxiety because of the sensory issues created by the fluorescent lighting in this case. And this is something that, like with social skills and learning nonverbal communication, requires direct instruction. So let's take an example. Many people, when they're lost, have stopped at a gas station or somebody walking by the side of the road and asked for directions. Pretty common thing to do. The person will start issuing these directions, and then the person receiving them, they suddenly say, oh, can you hold on a minute? I need to get a piece of paper to write this down because I'm not going to remember it all. And anyone who has done this has engaged in self-advocacy. They've gone through the three-step process of scanning the situation, in this case, finding a cognitive challenge. And that cognitive challenge is they're not going to remember the 24 steps to get from one point to another. So once upon determining the challenge, they've advocated on their own. They didn't yell at the person providing the directions. They didn't have a meltdown. They didn't beat them up. But they just simply said, can you give me a moment while I get something to write these down? That's explaining your needs. And then there's the disclosure, giving the reason why. I'm not going to be able to remember all of this. And so for those of us with autism, this is an area that may require direct instruction, where we can teach how to scan the environment for challenges, determine what's causing the difficulty, then explaining our needs in a way that promotes greater understanding and in a way that another person can provide assistance. And then finally, there's the disclosure. And there's the option of partial and full. A partial disclosure or the reason for fluorescent lights in a workplace might be as simple as, oh, these, I have sensitive eyes, these lights give me a headache. And no mention would be made of autism. To the employer, who is giving a set of directions on how to complete a job. Well, the reason might be, I remember things much better when I have a chance to write them down, as opposed to doing a full disclosure of, well, I have autism, these are the characteristics, and that's probably just way too much information. And the important point with advocacy is that advocacy is a tool, it's a choice. Knowing how to advocate doesn't mean that it's always appropriate or even a good idea to advocate in a particular situation. I think the best way to look at advocacy is that when the effect of having autism significantly impacts a situation or a relationship, then it's time, and there is a need for better mutual understanding, then it becomes necessarily, or it becomes necessary to at least consider advocating for oneself. And then the choice can be made, is it a good idea to do so or not? So we've covered, today we've talked about a number of things to keep in mind, things to consider as we go about promoting success for individuals with autism as we work towards moving from a deficit model or a weakness model of autism and by extension other disabilities to perhaps a more characteristics-based model where we can look at the strengths of people with autism, their interests, and finding ways to translate that to success throughout life. Some of the things we've looked at are examining what those interests and strengths are. We've looked at reframing the characteristics. So rather than looking at the characteristics of somebody with Asperger's syndrome as deficits, and today we talked about characteristics of communication, factual, detailed, to the point, truthful, repetitive. Perhaps there's a way we can look at that as a strength, perhaps, in giving direction. We looked at various abilities, such as my mechanical ability and the way my parents used those abilities in which to develop a real skill in bicycle repair, which was great for employment in high school and in college. We looked at unusual sensory preferences, such as the teenager who enjoyed the sensory input of spraying water at high pressure and examining what possibilities there may be for this person in terms of employment. We've also looked at some ways of educating individuals with autism on the unspoken rules of social interaction, otherwise known as the hidden curriculum. And finally, we examined how we might work on educating individuals with autism, how to effectively advocate for their own needs so that they can be successful, whether it's an employment situation, in the community, in education, or in a relationship with another person. Thank you very much for your participation. And if anybody has any questions, I am ready.
Wonderful. If you're participating via the internet, you can submit a question on your little blue box. And if you're listening on the phone and you'd like to ask a question, please press star 2 on your keypad, and that will raise your hand and alert me that you have a question you'd like to talk to Stephen. Excuse me, I'm getting over a cold, so I'm starting to lose my voice a little bit, which happens about every night. My husband is thrilled. We had a couple of questions come in. I'll go ahead and ask one. Barb from Portland asks, as a special ed teacher of children with Asperger's, I find it frustrating for some of these kids to be put into classes where they're set up for failure. They could learn so much more using their strengths if they weren't expected to fit into the box and do things like explain their thinking for every math problem. Do you agree?
Yes, I agree. People on the spectrum tend to learn differently, think differently. There are many situations, for example, where it looks like an individual may be exhibiting challenging behaviors in which to maybe to get attention from the teacher, to create a ruckus, or get out of doing work. And, you know, as you bring up math, I think the examples that I've seen or heard of where we have an individual with autism who perhaps is given a math worksheet along with everybody else in the class, and maybe they're so good at math that they've done all 10 problems or however many they are all in their heads, and they've done it within 60 seconds. So they scribble down the answers, and they're done. And now there's the other 29 minutes left to class, and now they're bored. And they get every answer correct, but they may not be able to explain how they get their answer. And in a situation like that, I think it's important for the educator to be aware of this different type of thinking. And rather than penalizing the individual for not being able to show their work, maybe we could find a way in which to teach them how to show their work, but not do it in such a way that their success is dependent on them showing their work. And also, perhaps we could find some other interesting things this individual could do as a sort of enrichment program that we might do for students who are talented and gifted. As many people on the autism spectrum are, we see talents and gifts, but at the same time, there are also significant challenges to address as well.
Along the same lines of explain your thinking, do you think there's a high percentage of individuals with maybe Asperger's syndrome that don't necessarily or can't necessarily show their work that are accused of cheating?
There probably are.
Yeah.
And I think the best thing to do with that is, well, one, first I find that people on the autism spectrum tend to be very honest. But if an educator is concerned about an individual with autism cheating, or say on a math worksheet or test or quiz, then there are many things that an educator can do to assure themselves that cheating is not happening, such as giving a different problem set. Or maybe, especially with the use of computers these days, each test may have the same questions, but they're in different locations or in different pages of the test. or maybe even moving to the person with autism to a place where you know they won't be able to look at somebody else's piece of paper. So these are some easy ways that one can determine if there's cheating going on or not.
Do you think maybe this is just my perception of from watching television or whatever, but do you think professors might be insulted by someone who can do the problems in their head and not show their work? They would take offense to that?
Yeah, there are people, there are educators who may be threatened by students, whether it's at the grade school level or even at the college level, who know more about a subject or perhaps even have better facility at a subject than they do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to realize that no matter how much an individual knows about something, no matter how good they are at something, there's almost always somebody else who can do it better or faster than others. And when that has happened to me in classes, I remember teaching a class at a career school. It was a vocational school. And I was teaching math. And there was this student who was whizzing through his math problems, his math quizzes, like nobody's business. And he wasn't writing. He wasn't showing how he did his work, but he was always getting the answers right. And so I asked him, you know, instead of accusing him of cheating and demanding that he show his work, I just asked him very kindly, you know, gee, this is really interesting. I was wondering how you came up with these answers. And what he did is he showed me a way of doing arithmetic calculations that I had never seen before, never even thought about doing them that way. Couldn't even really figure out how he was doing it, but somehow he was magically manipulating these numbers and getting the right answer. So if you, you know, as an educator, if you're open to listening to your students and watching them and, you know, treating them with respect and with people who may very well know more about something than you do, then there can be an awful lot to learn from them.
As a student and an educator, do you think because there's going to be so many individuals on the spectrum, like you said, maybe more than neurotypicals at some point, do you think there's going to need to be a complete overhaul of the educational system? Because what I'm finding with my own child is he doesn't fit anywhere.
Yeah, well, I think the whole thing needs to be overhauled anyways. No matter how many more people we end up with Asperger syndrome or autism or not, the way we've been doing things really isn't working anymore. And we need to find a way to re-engage students in education, to bring education, make education more relevant to the daily lives of individuals with autism and otherwise. I mean, what we're doing is we're asking people who are plugged into their iPhones and iPads or other electronic devices all the way to school, and then we're asking them to put these things away and learn in a way that they haven't grown up with. In other words, pencils and paper. And I think what we need to do is find ways to embrace the technology. And what this does mean is finding ways to use social media, using such as Facebook, using texting in education, emails, instant message, and finding ways to incorporate them in our education as opposed to trying to battle against them, which is a losing battle because technology marches on and we need to use technology as our friend as opposed to thinking of it as an enemy. Insofar as developing teaching, working on teaching styles and developing accommodations, what I find is that accommodations, while we may initially think that they're these these special, time-consuming, and expensive things that we do just for a few people, if we can find a way to incorporate this accommodation into the general class instruction, then really accommodations are just extensions of good teaching practice. Mm-hmm. So, for example, there may be a student who needs to have a schedule in order to feel centered, calm, and organized in the class. So perhaps a teacher or a paraprofessional would spend some time before class going over the student's schedule with them, and in particular, notating any changes. Maybe today math will be canceled and we have a school assembly in its place. And so we'd make sure that we note that and the student understands it. But maybe what I would do is instead refer to a big schedule that have a bulletin board on the wall, like many classrooms do. And as part of the opening routine of every day, let's go over the schedule and see what we're doing for every period. And then when it came time to math period, which we've now changed to a school assembly, maybe I would ask that student with autism to become the schedule manager. And students tend to like to have jobs. They tend to like to do things. And the job of the schedule manager, in this case, would be to take the card that has the word assembly on it and stick it right on top of the math block to show that today we have a school assembly. And what that does is get the individual with autism physically involved with the change, and this effort is worked into the general teaching of the class, where all the students can benefit from going over the schedule and notating the change. And that's what I mean by bringing what was an expensive in terms of time and could be money accommodation that we're doing for one person, and looking at it as really an extension of good teaching practice and everybody benefiting as a result. And in that way, moving curriculum towards a more universal design and being able to access more students.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, our educational system is woefully behind technology. I mean, there's computers in classrooms, but a lot of times they're still the desktops, you know, and just very antiquated.
Right. And I think part of the challenge is that there needs to be more support given to educators on how to use these things in education. Because often behind the teacher who refuses to learn to use a smart board or some other technological device, who refuses to teach to modify their teaching style as needed, or even refuses to teach a person or complains about teaching an individual on the spectrum or with other disability, that is the teacher who has not received sufficient support in terms of education, training, and given time to collaborate with others in order to teach that individual successfully.
Mm-hmm. Mark from LA asks, my high school son with HFA, and I know you don't particularly care for the terms high functioning and low functioning, but a lot of times we don't know what else to substitute. My high school son with high functioning autism doesn't seem to care about his grades. He has been on honor roll and now has fallen to a 2.5. Any suggestions for helping with this situation?
Yeah, well, it's a difficult question. There's a lot of reasons why something like that could happen. And in order to address this issue, I'd need a lot more information. But things that I would think about is whether there was some change in the student's life or schedule, because often a transition can be very challenging.